1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Polls show Donald Trump in the lead ahead of the New Hampshire primary on Tuesday. And on the final weekend of campaigning, Nikki Haley has ramped up attacks on Trump's age, he's 77, and President Biden, who's 81.
This is the fact that we have a country in disarray and a world on fire, and we need to know that we are not giving our kids options of two 80-year-olds going into a presidency.
The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry now says more than 25,000 Palestinians have been killed since the Israel-Hamas war began. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres renewing his call for a ceasefire, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in a message the war will continue on all fronts and in all sectors. Tens of millions of people in the U.S. continuing to deal with extreme cold. It's been dangerous, blamed for 67 deaths across the country. And for the second straight week, Mean Girls led the box office. This is ABC News. Writer E. Jean Carroll seeking at least $10 million in defamation damages from former President Trump. The trial continues this week, and ABC's Rena Roy tells us what's at stake.
The writer says Trump ruined her reputation and made her the target of violent threats when he denied her accusations of sexual assault. Carroll is seeking at least $10 million in damages. And this trial has been full of heated moments in court. Last week, the judge putting the former president on notice that he could be kicked out of the courtroom if he keeps making disparaging side comments about Carroll within earshot of the jury. Trump has denied any wrongdoing and has said he doesn't know who Carroll is.
Sources tell ABC Trump is expected to be in court Monday. Today, Stanford women's basketball coach Tara Vanderveer can break the all-time career record for college basketball coaching wins when the Cardinal plays Oregon State. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
This is John Mino.
And I'm Jim Schmidt. And together, we're Mino and the Mayor on the talk of Green Bay, WGBW, 97.9 FM and 1590 AM, weekday mornings from 6 to 8.
As our audience grows, we're looking to find an experienced outside marketing professional to join our civic media team to work with local business owners who want to grow.
Not only does WGBW reach qualified radio listeners, we help business owners reach customers on their mobile phones, tablets, even on screens at the gas pump.
The person who joins our team needs to be as motivated as we are to bring great local radio to Green Bay and Northeast Wisconsin. Someone with a creative streak and no fear of introducing themselves and us to the Green Bay business community.
If you're listening to us now, imagine how many others are and how we can help business owners reach the customers they want to do business with.
To apply, email me directly. My name is Chris Morrow, Vice President of Sales. My email address is chris.moreau@civicmedia.us. chris.moreau@civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Winter is an especially dangerous time for people with Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. Mark Moran explains.
People who suffer from dementia face a host of increased risks in winter months. Everything from falls to getting lost, even in places that used to be familiar. And in the winter, the Alzheimer's Association's Lauren Livingston says low temperatures, ice, and darkness are just a few things that make conditions especially dangerous for people with dementia, but there are others.
One big one is wandering. That can be a problem for people living with Alzheimer's or dementia, especially in severe weather. They don't really understand maybe when they go outside that it's dangerous, so they might not put on any coats or additional clothing to keep warm. And if they wander, they may get lost and not be able to find their way home.
Livingston says keeping track of people with dementia in the winter is especially critical. Memory problems are hallmark signs of people living with dementia, but Livingston says there's another equally debilitating symptom called sundowning, which is made worse in shorter, darker days.
It can cause them to become a little bit more agitated in the evening time when the sun is going down, and with the sunlight being less and less in the winter time, it can cause for a longer period of time for people with dementia to experience the sundowning and be more agitated.
She adds that people with dementia are also more prone to falls, a risk made worse by snowy, icy weather. There are currently more than 6 million people nationwide living with Alzheimer's disease. There's no cure and very few treatments available proven to slow its progress. This is Mark Moran. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Wind chill advisory to start your Sunday. Wind chill values between 15 and 25 below zero. We'll see mostly sunny skies, increasing south winds up to around 25 miles per hour, highs of the upper teens. Overnight, we expect a couple of snow showers to develop. It's 12 at our studios.
Mino and the Mayor in the morning, and the talk of Green Bay all day long. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a new recording, man.
Yeah, brother, dig it. Stop it. Right on.
There's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find.
Good morning and welcome to a very, very special edition of the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Good morning to you, Calvin. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good, Earl. I think we're going to start trending towards the warmer direction starting today.
Yeah, we're going from, what, 20 below to 7 or 8 below. I I don't know if we can really tell the difference, but I guess every degree makes a difference. But I want to say to the listening audience that we're about to go on what I think is as important a conversation that I've ever been a part of. And I want you all to listen intently to what you're about to hear. We constantly on this program talk about our government. We talk about the fact that, you know, it's a representative government, and so we vote and we do all those things, and we expect our government to do so many things for us because we aren't certainly capable of dealing with all the different things that go on in a society. And so it is important, critically important, that we have conversations like the one that we are about to have. And this is all about a conversation, and it's called gain of function. And I don't know how many of you in the listening audience are aware of what gain of function means, but we're about to find that out along with many other important discussions that are included in gain of function. And I want to begin by introducing three scientists and professors. And, you know, these bios will, if nothing else, I hope they don't scare you away. But these are very, very accomplished men who are going to take the time out to explain to us in a language that hopefully we can understand about the importance of gain of function and some really important things that are happening not only in the state of Wisconsin but across the nation. I want to begin by introducing Richard H. Ebright. He is a Board of Governors professor of chemistry and chemical biology at Rutgers University and laboratory director at Waxman Institute of Microbiology. He received his PhD in microbiology from Harvard University and was junior fellow of the Harvard University Society of Fellows. In 1987, he was appointed as a laboratory director at the Waxman Institute and faculty member at Rutgers University from 1997 to 2013. He was co-appointed as investigator of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. He has received the Surly Scholar Award, the Schering Plug Award of the American Society for Biochemistry and Molecular Biology, and the National Institutes of Health Merit Award. If that doesn't scare you away, he is also a fellow of the American Academy of Microbiology, the Infectious Diseases Society of America, the American Association for Advancement of Science, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He is a member of the Institute International Biosafety Committee of Rutgers and has been a member of the Antimicrobial Resistance Committee of the Infectious Diseases Society of America, the Working Group of Pathogen Security of the State of New Jersey, and the Controlling Dangerous Pathogens Project of the Center for International Security Studies. He has testified to U.S. House and the U.S. Senate on biosafety, biosecurity, and biorisk management. Whew. And that's just part of what he's accomplished. Let's go now to Simon Wayne Hobson. He is an emeritus professor of virology at the Institute of Pasteur Paris. Wayne Hobson obtained a PhD in biochemistry from the University of Oxford in 1977, served as a postdoctoral fellow at the Weizmann Institute of Science from 1977 to 1980, and thereafter moved to the Pasteur Institute in Paris. He and his colleagues were the first to sequence the genome of the virus that causes AIDS. Man, man. Wow. Wayne Hobson is the co-founder of two biotech companies working to develop countermeasures against cancer. Wayne Hobson won the Andre Wolf Prize in 1996 and Athena Prize from the French Academy of Sciences in 2007, and as Officer de la Lyon of UNAR, Wayne Hobson was appointed Officer of the Order of the British Empire in 2022 from his services in the field of virology. Bryce Nichols is Professor of Genetics at Rutgers University and Laboratory Director at the Waxman Institute of Microbiology. He received a PhD in microbiology from Harvard University in 2002 and served as a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard Medical School from 2002 to 2007. In 2007, he was appointed as laboratory director at the Waxman Institute and faculty member at Rutgers University. He has received the Pew Scholar Award and is a fellow of the American Academy of Microbiology. In 2023, he and Richard Ebright were two co-founders of Biosafety Now, a nonpartisan New Jersey-based 501c3 nonprofit organization whose primary mission is to protect public safety by reducing the likelihood of laboratory-generated pandemics. Good morning to you all, and thank you very much for taking time out of your busy mornings to share with our audience.
Thanks, Earl. Thanks a lot for having us on. And I guess I will say that we really appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak to the public. And I know, I guess I would say that one of the things is, you know, reading those bios and stuff, like it, I kind of want to point out that we're here in a sense because we're all members of the public. I think that these accolades and you know, having the degrees, they don't make us, you know, the key thing here is that we're coming here because we need the public's help, because we're concerned as scientists that we're, the scientific community is using those credentials to sort of, you know, tell the public that everything's okay, And we don't need to be, you know, regulated. We don't need certain things to be prohibited that we're doing. But the reality is that that's just not true. So that's really what we're here for. As you said, I'm one of the co-founders of BioSafety Now, along with Richard Ebright and Justin Kinney, who's not on here today. But myself and Justin actually traveled to Wisconsin this past Wednesday in order to testify on behalf to support a new bill that Richard's going to go into more detail on, that would prohibit the topic that we're talking today, which is gain of function research, but also would introduce much needed public transparency, which is something that's not being discussed a lot about that bill, which is the fact that a lot of the activities that scientists are doing are done in secret, without the public's knowledge, and importantly, without the public's consent. And that's really why I think this particular bill is one that everyone should rally around as sort of an apolitical bill. It should receive bipartisan support. And that's really what our goal is, to sort of make it clear that this is about public safety. It's about public welfare. It's about putting common sense protections on the public. Calvin, you have a question?
Well, no. So guys, before we get into all of that, I have to ask you a question from the perspective of the community. We have just come out of a terrifying COVID-19 couple years ago that terrified America to its soul. And we were hearing different things from different people, not knowing whom to trust, where it came from, what the solutions were, whether we should take vaccinations or not. We're still there. And so if you guys can explain to us, as we saw so many loved ones die and did not get, I guess, a real understanding about where COVID-19 came from and what pathogens are and all of those different things, if you guys could take us, walk us down that path before we get into the rest of it.
Richard, you want to take that one, or Simon?
Richard, please.
Something to focus on would be where it came from.
Yes, sir.
One of the questions you raised. So all available evidence indicates that SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, entered humans through one of two possible routes. The one route is natural spillover, in which a virus circulating in wildlife, in animals, makes the jump to humans and infects humans and spreads from there. The second possibility is a laboratory incident, a virus being studied in a laboratory jumps to humans, most typically by infecting a laboratory worker, a researcher, or even a maintenance worker or janitorial staff, and then is transmitted to the community and spreads from there. Two possible origins.
So, Professor, if you guys can hang on a second, we've got to take a short hiatus. When we come back, I want to pick up Richard from that point. I think it's clearly important. I am so honored to have on this morning Professor Richard E. Bright, Professor Bryce Nichols, and Professor Simon Wayne Hobson, all the way from Paris, France, who is joining us this morning, 844-967-2789. We're discussing gain of function on the Earl Ingram Show. To bring some love and pity today. Picket lines, sister, and picket signs, sister. Don't punish me, sister, with brutality.
This is the talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
Are record energy costs putting a squeeze on your fixed or limited incomes? With inflation rising at record levels and incomes not keeping pace, you might be one of tens of thousands of Wisconsin residents who are struggling to survive in the blistering heat of summer or the bitter cold of winter. While you haven't asked for it, the Keep Wisconsin Warm Cool Fund and your local energy assistance providers are here to help.
No Wisconsin resident should ever have to face the challenge of living without heat or power or face homelessness. For a hand up, apply today and call 1-800-506-5596 or visit www.kwwf.org. That's 800-506-5596 or visit www.kwwf.org.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
All right, welcome back to a very special edition of the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. I am so excited and to introduce to you my guests this morning, Professor Bryce Nichols, Professor Simon Wayne Hobson, and Professor Richard H. Ebright, as we talk about gain of function. Professor Ebright, before we went to break, I was talking about the COVID virus, but I guess maybe where I should have began was, what is a pathogen?
That's a good question. A pathogen is an agent that causes an infectious disease. Examples would be viruses, bacteria, microbiological parasites. So a pathogen is what you would call a germ.
And so as COVID was coming into existence and the American people were terrified, and there were some who said it was certainly something that occurred from an animal. You said the other option was that it happened in a scientific arena. Nobody knows to this day.
There clearly are two possibilities, which I described before. Natural spillover came from an animal. Laboratory spillover, it came from a laboratory. We do not know definitively the answer, but a preponderance of evidence now indicates that it came to humans through laboratory spillover. And if you would, I could summarize what those lines of evidence are. Make 10 points. The first point is that the pandemic is caused by a bat, SARS-like coronavirus, and emerged in the city of Wuhan, which is a city that's 800 miles from the nearest wild bats with SARS-CoV-2-like coronaviruses, but that contains the labs that were conducting the world's largest research program on precisely that category of viruses. If one considers the timeline in 2015 to 2017, so that's 4 years before the pandemic to 2 years before the pandemic, scientists and science policy specialists expressed concern that the Wuhan Institute of Virology, a laboratory in Wuhan, was conducting and contemplating research that posed an unacceptable risk of a lab accident that would trigger a pandemic. So there were concerns about the specific research project in that specific location already in 2015 to 2017. Then in 2017 to 2018, the Wuhan Institute of Virology constructed a novel hybrid SARS-like coronavirus. That is a virus that combined parts of one bat SARS-like coronavirus with parts of another bat SARS-like coronavirus. And the resulting artificial engineered hybrid coronavirus was able to infect and replicate in human airway cells, human lung and tracheal cells. And when it did so, it had 10,000 times enhanced viral growth and 4 times enhanced lethality in mice that were engineered to display human SARS receptors on their cells. Then in 2018, just 1 year before the outbreak arises, in a National Institutes of Health NIH grant proposal, the Wuhan Institute of Virology and its collaborators proposed to construct more such hybrid SARS-like coronaviruses, specifically aiming for chimeras that would replace the natural spike gene, the gene that controls the specificity of the virus for what species it targets, with novel spike genes that had higher binding affinities to human cells. And also in 2018, again, just 1 year before the outbreak, in a Department of Defense grant proposal, Wuhan Institute of Virology and its collaborators proposed to insert a special sequence that enhances, where it is expected to enhance, the ability of the virus to infect and propagate, a sequence called a furin cleavage site. And they proposed to insert that at a specific location in the genome, in the nucleic acids, the genetic information for bat SARS-like coronaviruses. Then throughout that period, in 2017 to 2019, they did this research using a biosafety standard called Biosafety Level 2. This is a biosafety standard that every dentist's office in the United States meets. This is not what you see in pictures of people working in spacesuits. This is like a dental office. And it's a biosafety level that's patently inadequate, utterly inadequate for work with an enhanced potential pandemic pathogen, such as they were constructing. And then we know in 2019, a novel SARS-like coronavirus that had a spike with high binding affinity for human cells and that had a furin cleavage site at precisely the location proposed in their Department of Defense proposal emerges on their doorstep. And that virus is the only one of more than 870 known SARS-like coronaviruses that contains that key feature called the furin cleavage site. It also has genetic features that are unusual for bat SARS-related coronaviruses. These are features that don't rule out a natural origin, but are explained much, much more easily by a lab origin, specifically a lab origin that involves the category of research known as gain-of-function research, which is research in which scientists, by intent, introduce features into the virus or into a bacterium, so into a pathogen, introduce features that are reasonably expected to increase the ability to transmit or reasonably expected to increase the ability to do damage and kill.
So you so you mentioned the Department of Defense, and Wuhan is in China. United States Department of Defense engaged, involved with this. The purpose of it, what is the purpose of creating such a virus?
Yes, it was two parts to that. First, the National Institutes of Health is a United States government funding agency. The Department of Defense that I'm referring to is the United States Department of Defense. The United States federal government was directly involved in this research project, instrumentally funding this project through the United States Agency for International Development, through the National Institutes of Health, and the researchers requested additional funds from the United States Department of Defense. So the second part of your question is why? This is research that is not pursued to develop new vaccines or new drugs. This research has no civilian applications. It has no medical value. It has no industrial value. It has no commercial value. So the research is not being performed to improve your health or my health or your listeners' health. The research is being performed for other reasons.
844-967-2789. We've got to go to a short hiatus, a very, very special edition of the Earl Ingram Show. I'm joined by Professors Bryce Nichols, Professor Simon Wayne Hobson, and Professor Richard E. Ebright as we have a discussion about a bill that is in docket in UW-Madison, Assembly Bill AB 413. And gain of function is what this is about. And so we're gonna delve into it. So don't touch that dial. 844-967-2789. We'll return.
Broadcasting from the City Deck Studios on North Washington Street, the talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Polls show Donald Trump in the lead ahead of the New Hampshire primary on Tuesday. And on the final weekend of campaigning, Nikki Haley has ramped up attacks on Trump's age, he's 77, and President Biden, who's 81.
This is the fact that we have a country in disarray and a world on fire, and we need to know that we are not giving our kids options of two 80-year-olds going into a presidency.
The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry now says more than 25,000 Palestinians have been killed since the Israel-Hamas war began. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres renewing his call for a ceasefire, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in a message the war will continue on all fronts and in all sectors. Tens of millions of people in the U.S. continuing to deal with extreme cold. It's been dangerous, blamed for 67 deaths across the country. And for the second straight week, Mean Girls led the box office. This is ABC News.
The Packers season comes to a close. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Green Bay led the 49ers through three quarters in the rain at Levi's Stadium, but the defense dropped two interceptions on special teams. Kicker Anders Carlson missed one from 41 yards out.
I knew the wind was right to left, and my goal was to play a little right middle, and the contact off my foot started just a little too much left, and so by the end it played out. You got to have better contact.
The 49ers held on to win 24-21. In the final minute, Jordan Love throwing a pass across his body that was intercepted.
You know, play broke down, was scrambling right, saw Christian over the middle, tried forcing one into him, thought I could make the play.
So a Green Bay Packers team that was 2-5 that managed to get into the playoffs as the seventh seed nearly beats the 49ers. Green Bay finishing the season overall with a record of 10-9. Packers head coach Matt LaFleur.
It's always tough unless you're the last team standing, and for us to lose this game certainly stings, and I'm sure it's going to sting for a long time.
From Levi's Stadium in California, I'm Mike Clemens.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Windchill advisory to start your Sunday. Windchill values between 15 and 25 below zero. We'll see mostly sunny skies, increasing south winds up to around 25 miles per hour. Highs in the upper teens. Overnight, we expect a couple of snow showers to develop. Right now, it's 13.
Hi, I'm Pete Schwabe, an actor, writer, director, and comedian. Join me for my new show, Nightlight, here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll chill after a long day in traffic, talking politics, or trying to look busy at work. We'll talk movies, TV, theater, music, and lots of fun Wisconsin stuff. So mix an old-fashioned and join the discussion. We'll go from Wisconsin to Hollywood and back, and you can still be in bed by 10. It's Nightlight with Pete Schwabe, weeknights from 8 to 10, on the Talk of Green Bay, 97.9 FM, WGBW.
Some days, my active psoriatic arthritis makes it hard to get in the game. Now, the ball is in my court, thanks to treating my skin and joints with SkyRizi, Risankizumab Riza, a prescription-only 150-milligram injection for adults.
Nothing is everything.
SkyRizi helps with less joint pain, stiffness, swelling, and fatigue. For those who also have plaque psoriasis, 90% clearer skin is possible with just 4 doses a year after 2 starter doses.
Don't use if allergic to SkyRizi. Serious allergic reactions and an increased risk of infections or a lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check for infection and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms, such as fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, or if you plan to or recently received a vaccine.
With SkyRizi, there's nothing like clearer skin and better movement, and that means everything. Ask your doctor today about SkyRizi and visit SkyRizi.com or call 1-866-SKY-RIZI to learn more.
Progressive asks, what do a middle school slumber party?
Let's stay up all night.
Yeah!
A sleep-deprived girl. An early morning paper route. And a poorly thrown rolled-up newspaper have in common?
Hey, my window!
They can become a fast-breaking news story.
Sorry, Mr. Thompson.
Bundle your home and auto with Progressive for great savings and round-the-clock protection.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company affiliates and other insurers. Not available in all states or situations.
Your home for the Devil's Advocates. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6. The Talk of Green Bay. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
$9.99 a month.
A long time coming, but I know.
Welcome back to a special edition of the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. I'm joined by Professor Bryce Nichols, Professor Simon Wayne Hobson, and Professor Richard H. Ebright, and it's a discussion on gain of function. And so what I'm going to do, gentlemen, is I want to ask a couple of questions to each Bryce and Simon, and then I'm going to get out of the way and let you guys have the dialogue and the conversation that is needed and better had by the three of you to make sure that our audience is aware of what's what is really taking place and what's at stake. But I want to go to you next, Simon, and I want to ask you about you and others and scientists and what the importance of scientific study. None of us can challenge some of the great things that have come out of scientific study that have benefited mankind. And so we don't know historically about what those things are. We just trust, and I don't know how much science is regulated by the government, and so we trust that the things that are taking place in science are to benefit mankind. You say what, sir?
I think it's actually understandable. You see, virology is probably best left to the virologists because they know the details, and therefore we can have these arcane discussions between us and sort out problems, come up with vaccines and develop drugs and find out how viruses work, which always is useful in how we handle them and treat them. But I think there are times in not just virology, in science, where science has to engage the public. I don't think the public wants to know all of the small details of virology, but there are a few moments when the public is particularly piqued, and they like the HIV. When HIV came along, said, "Where the hell did it come from?" And so the same with COVID origins. And there are times with the gain of function debate, which is making novel human viruses or heating up an animal virus and making sure it can cause disease in humans, where we have to engage the public. And I think it's a bit like politics. You don't want to hear the politicians talking about all the bills going through Congress, some of which will maybe bore you to death, but we know you have to be done. But there are some of those bills which concern you for various reasons. And I think we have the problem in virology. We have to open up occasionally, not because some people necessarily want to. As you know, scientists are sometimes not very good at communicating, but because we have to. We do not function in a vacuum. We scientists engage with the public. We need public funding, not only public funding, but funding from philanthropic organizations like the Gates Foundation. We need to open up, and on the gain of function, it's an area where we need to engage, because let's face it, people are morphing animal viruses that could then efficiently spread between humans, and they could kill humans. We just don't know, because as your listeners are very aware, no one will be allowed to infect a human with any of these viruses. So what these experiments are doing, they're producing new viruses, and they say, well, this could do this, this could do that. They haven't got the slightest idea. And I think that's why I got into it, because I realized that this was the kind of time we had to open up. And this came from my experience, my period in AIDS, because as your listeners will know, the first years of AIDS, the scientists proved to be rather arrogant. They said all sorts of things. They said we'd have a vaccine in 2 years. And as you know, 40 years later, we still don't have one. And they said silly things. And the virologists were sort of forced to, because they had their faces rubbed in the dirt, to sort of say, well, yes, we do have to engage. And I've been to conferences where I've had a very moving talk from a drug addict who was HIV plus, or a homosexual is HIV plus, or a black African, or someone from India and Indonesia who had AIDS, and they were talking about the ravage of this. We understood, we got to learn. And I think the flu community, and in general, outside of HIV, the virologists don't realize this need to engage, not on everything, occasionally. And I think this is the error. And to sort of say, hide behind institutions like, and not just the, you know, the NIH, it's happened in Europe, sort of saying, we know what we're doing. This is not the way to do it. And the public don't, they don't buy into it. They see through it. And then they say, why don't you want to engage? And this controversy has been going on for 12 years, Earl, 12 years.
You know, as a guy who grew up 50s and 60s, and we used to see the mad scientist movies, right? Are you telling me that part of that is kind of a reality, that there are guys who and people and scientists who, without being regulated, are dealing with some things that really are genuinely dangerous to?
Since you mentioned the 50s and the 60s, you know, that was a period where we talked about science fiction.
Right.
Right. Well, there was a novel written in the late 50s where someone had taken a virus that infects rice, and they had jiggled with it, and they made this virus devastating. And it was made into a film called, I think it's The Blade of Grass. And basically, it devastated rice production. Of course, as you know, China, India, Indonesia, all these countries, if they didn't have rice, you would have massive malnutrition. And so it was that. And basically, it was science fiction. Even when I got into AIDS, it was science fiction. Yes, people said it was made by the CIA, it was made by the KGB. This was just fiction, but it sounded good, and so people talked about it. But, and as Bryce and Richard can tell you, from about, say, the mid, about 2002, 3, 4, 5, we now have a technology that is so powerful that we can jigger viruses, we can make, we can adapt, and hence make new pathogens. It could be a pathogen for humans, but it could be a pathogen for dogs or cats, or it could be a pathogen for rice. We can do it if we put our minds to it. And the three of us say, are on your show, we sort of say, well, you know, we don't want to make a new cat virus. We don't want to make a virus for rice, and certainly not for humans. And our sort of shock and surprise is that we are in a minority, Earl.
So, Earl, can I bring up a very clear point about this?
Absolutely.
I
think it, absolutely.
So this is the one I think that most people are just like, wait, what happened? So there's this virus that took out, how many people died in the 1918 pandemic, or the Richard or Simon? How many people, like 50 million people died?
Yes, you can play with numbers, but 50 is a round number that most people would agree with.
So this is the thing. You had a virus that was known to wipe out millions of people, and it was eliminated from the planet Earth. And the scientists, including one at Wisconsin, said, I know what we should do. Let's make that in a lab so we can study it again. When I tell that to most people, they say, I mean, some even say, did they get thrown in prison? And I say, no, in fact, they were given awards and given more money to do this. I think when people understand the stakes, that a scientist made a decision to reconstruct a virus that killed millions and was eradicated from the planet Earth, we need to understand, like, something's wrong. That happened in the mid-2000s, Richard?
Like, 2005.
Right, that was nearly 20 years ago. And the pub, and again, this is the Kawaoka, who's this researcher at Wisconsin, is one of the people involved in that. I think that example shows how literally scientists are making decisions that I think most of the public would find egregious and unethical. And that doesn't even qualify as gain of function, frankly, because you're creating just you're actually making something that did exist in nature but was eliminated. So just to give you one example of things that have already happened, and that was 20 years ago.
So
what we can do now is, yeah.
So it's one thing to say that what happened in Wuhan, China, it's far away from our country, and yet there are things that are happening and could be similar right in our own backyards and our universities that we are not aware of. Is it safe to say that that's the context of what we're talking about?
Absolutely. But what happened in Wuhan didn't, you know, it didn't stay there. This is the problem. Right. Some of these pathogens that, you know, they're potential pandemic pathogens, which means the spread of them is global. It's a global issue. So this Wisconsin. So actually, that's why we're so, you know, we're so focused on Wisconsin now, because Wisconsin is right now sort of ground zero in the battle to ban gain of function, because it's not just about Wisconsin. It's about the globe. So that's really what's at stake and why, you know, we are, as Simon said, we're in the minority in scientists to say that, look, this is, we need to be stopped. I mean, this idea that we should be allowed to do whatever we want, is pure insanity. You wouldn't allow chemical companies, tobacco companies to do what we're doing, unregulated with no force of law. So why let scientists do it? Because, you know, the public trusts them. I think that's really what we've done. We've betrayed the trust of the public.
Can you define gain of function for the listeners?
Yeah. So that will be a Richard question, because this is all actually, this is actually an issue, right? The language is all, and Simon has some thoughts of this too.
So currently, the United States government has a policy. The policy refers to enhanced potential pandemic pathogens research. It's called gain of function research, or gain of function research of concern, because a previous U.S. policy used that definition and that title. The research under either name, enhanced potential pandemic pathogens research or gain of function research, is research that's reasonably anticipated, that means reasonably expected, to increase either the transmissibility or the pathogenicity of a potential pandemic pathogen. Wherein a potential pandemic pathogen is a pathogen that could have global spread, cause a global pandemic, like the pandemic that still is underway with COVID-19.
You know what this sounds like to me? Correct me if I'm wrong. At the root of a lot of this is military. It's the creations of some of these things could be used if to deal with enemies and trying to control that it just deals with the enemies. I mean, our nation has some history of having done some things.
Each gain of function research activity creates a new biological weapons agent, a new bioweapon agent. The focus of why it is being performed only in part comes from military interests, but in part it does come from military interests, from biodefense and threat characterization, a sense that nations have that they need to perform this research to assess what threats might be developed by another nation. So there is a focus that comes from the military, but there also is a focus that comes out of the broader virology and bacteriology communities, the microbiology communities of researchers.
So, guys, hold that thought. 844-967-2789, a very special edition of the Earl Ingram Show. I'm joined by three great scientists, Bryce Nichols, Simon Wayne Hobson, he's all the way from Paris, France, with us this morning, and Professor Richard E. Ebright. We're talking about gain of function. 844-967-2789, only on the Earl Ingram Show.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
Are record energy costs putting a squeeze on your fixed or limited incomes?
With inflation rising at record levels and incomes not keeping pace, you might be one of tens of thousands of Wisconsin residents who are struggling to survive in the blistering heat of summer or the bitter cold of winter. While you haven't asked for it, the Keep Wisconsin Warm Cool Fund and your local energy assistance providers are here to help. No Wisconsin resident should ever have to face the challenge of living without heat or power or face homelessness. For a hand up, apply today and call 1-800-506-5596 or visit www.kwwf.org. That's 800-506-5596 or visit www.kwwf.org.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Very special edition of the Earl Ingram Show. I'm joined by professors Bryce Nichols, Simon Wayne Hobson, all the way from Paris, France, this morning, and Richard H. Ebright, as they are talking about an assembly bill that it's being discussed in UW-Madison, of all places, AB 413. Let's go to the phone lines. Dave from Milwaukee. Dave, be brief. You have a question or comment?
Yes, I'd like your guest to speak to the role of animal agriculture in the production of pathogens.
Thank you very much for the call. Guys?
Yes, you know, and your listener will know probably pretty well that antibiotic drug resistance can emerge in animals because they are used in animal husbandry, and then that resistance can move over into human pathogens. So in that respect, yes. As you know, frequently when you have an outbreak of a disease, often a troop of cattle will be slaughtered if they have foot and mouth disease virus. And as you've seen with the bird flu H5N1, whole flocks and sometimes millions of birds are simply killed to try and control the virus. But yes, I think probably it's most pronounced in the antibiotic resistance field. Yes,
go ahead, Bryce.
Oh, sorry. Can I build
Absolutely.
On that for a second?
Absolutely.
Because one of the issues that came up at the hearing, one of the questions I got was about whether this research that we're talking about is needed to combat pathogens that affect agriculture. So I had pointed out, as Simon just said, that you know, working on pathogens that affect, you know, plants or livestock presents a problem if they get out of the lab because they can infect that. But I think, yeah, Richard, you had the point about the fact that the actual work that's being done at Madison presents an actual threat to the actual main agricultural piece of the Wisconsin economy. Is that, if you want to just mention that, because I.
Well, so one laboratory at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, the only laboratory, as far as we know, that performs the category of research that we're talking about, gain of function research on potential pandemic pathogens in the state of Wisconsin. That laboratory studies, among other things, avian influenza virus H5N1, a bird flu. H5N1 rarely infects humans, but when it infects humans, the effects are disastrous. The case fatality rate is on the order of 60 to 70%. So it rarely infects humans, poorly transmits among humans, but has very high lethality when it does. The laboratory in question at University of Wisconsin-Madison in 2011 engineered avian influenza virus H5N1 to be able to transmit efficiently among mammals by a respiratory aerosol droplet route by air, like SARS-CoV-2 transmits from person to person. That is a virus that, were it accidentally or deliberately released, or were it reconstructed by a hostile actor and deliberately released, that would potentially, indeed likely, cause a global pandemic like the one that we're suffering from currently, but with a likely much higher level of lethality, a much higher level of risk. That also is a virus that transmits among mammals. Dairy cattle are mammals. Swine are mammals. So this is a virus that poses a threat not only potentially to humans, but this is an engineered virus that also potentially poses a threat to livestock, to your dairy industry, to swine production industry across the country and across the world. So this was a virus that did not exist in nature, would likely not have come into existence in nature in decades, centuries, millennia, but now exists. It exists in a lab in Wisconsin. It exists in a lab in Rotterdam, in the Netherlands. It exists in labs elsewhere. And in any of those labs, were it to escape, it could likely cause an outbreak. That's the category of research that we're talking about. So and it's research.
Yeah. If I could add to that, Earl.
Yes, sir.
Not only that, but the information, the sort of the toolbook saying how to do it, gets out in the published literature. So you can say, well, while it's localized in Wisconsin or Rotterdam, maybe okay. But that now is out. It's worldwide public knowledge. It's not just US public knowledge. And there are hundreds of labs, if they chose, could reproduce it, or a state, a rogue state lab might want to do it. I don't know why, personally, because as we said, viruses go around the globe and come back to bite you. But it could be done.
So it's,
absolutely.
So it sounds like to me that what you are talking about is regulation. I don't know if there are regulations already in place, if they're global regulations, if there are regulations here in the state of Wisconsin, but it sounds like right now the state of Wisconsin is the hot spot for this discussion. Is that, Bryce,
is that a hot spot?
Yeah, and I'd like to, so this is the thing, okay, about the stakes right now, and I keep making this point. I believe this is ground zero. That's why, you know, we've made every effort to sort of get the message out right now. The pushback on the bill is actually coming from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we would argue that this bill is actually good for them because it protects them. I think Simon has this really good point about liability that I'd like him to say, because we are all supportive of science. We're not coming on here to say that you shut down science. We're saying
Yeah.
We're professional so scientists. We make our living doing science.
Yeah, I know. So we're funded by the NIH. Richard and I are. Can you make this point about the impact on Wisconsin, the actual university of this research, like what it actually puts the whole university at risk, we believe.
And so, gentlemen, before we do that, we've got to take a short hiatus. And it's a fascinating, fascinating discussion. We're so honored that you've decided to do it on Civic Media this morning. And for all of you who are just tuning in, I'm joined by three great professors and scientists, Bryce Nichols, Simon Wayne Hobson, all the way from Paris, France. Can we change places this morning, sir? And Richard H. Ebright, as they discuss Assembly Bill AB 413, gain of function. We'll be right back.
Where the fans own the team. This is the talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Governor Evers lays out his priorities for 2024 when he delivers his State of the State address. I'm News Director Terry Bell. Join Civic Media's Todd Albaugh and me as we bring you the governor's speech live, right here, Tuesday night at 7, followed by the Republican response. Todd and I will help you understand what it means for you, your family, and your community. Join us for the Governor's State of the State Address, Tuesday night at 7 here on your local Civic Media radio station and the Civic Media app.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.